the revisionists believed in the corporate state, militarism, and terrorism against their political opponents. They favored the outlawing of strikes. They were racist in the strict sense of favoring the separation of Jews and non-Jews. Israel's present entente with South Africa is not a new development. For the revisionists, for decades, the strongest Zionist faction, Begin was head of the Israel-South Africa Friendship Society before he became prime minister. And you recall that we've looked at the close links between the Bruderbond, the inner core of the South African National Party, and the Third Reich. Recall that a Third Reich agent basically was instrumental in helping to reorganize the Bruderbond, the core of the Nationalist Party in South Africa, along the lines of the Nazi Party in Germany. So it's interesting that we have Menachem Begin so closely affiliated with South Africa as well as with the fascist elements in Zionism. Now, the proposed military alliance between the NMO and the Third Reich, between that element of Zionism and the Third Reich, never actually took place to any significant extent, at least not that I have become aware of. However, it's interesting to note that there was an actual working pattern of cooperation established between the SS and the Haganah, one of the main Zionist organizations, and that basically both the Haganah and the SS were working together for some time to promote the policy of Jewish emigration to Israel. And we're going to take a look at this in just a second. Now, the information I'm going to present here comes from a book called The Order of the Death's Head, The Story of Hitler's SS. And The Order of the Death's Head was authored by a German anti-fascist writer named Heinz Hoene, whose last name is spelled H-O-H-N-E. And Hoene's The Order of the Death's Head was published in paperback by Ballantine Books, and its first copyright is 1966. And in The Order of the Death's Head, Hoene describes the policy of the SS towards the Jews, the pre-Final Solution attitude, before the Nazis came up with the idea, and which of course they put into practice, of exterminating the Jews, gassing them in the concentration camps. Basically, the Nazis worked to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine, and basically they sought to do a couple of things through this. First of all, they wanted to get all the Jews out of Germany, which of course is one of their main goals, since they were profoundly anti-Semitic. Secondly, and not unimportantly, they sought to drive a wedge, as I said before, into Britain's Mideast Empire, thereby weakening it. And, of course, the Nazis hoped to basically take over Britain's Middle East holdings eventually. And they saw the growing Jewish state in the Middle East as a strong wedge to help out that particular policy aim of the Third Reich. And as Hoene points out here in The Order of the Death's Head, apparently Zionist elements in Germany also found, initially, many of them found the racist policies of the Third Reich and Hitler to be beneficial to their situation because they felt it would stimulate Jewish immigration to Palestine. And so they were initially, many elements of the German Zionist community were rather sympathetic to Nazism in and of itself, saw it as a beneficial thing for them, and so they didn't argue against it. This is delineated in The Order of the Death's Head by Hoene as follows. For the Jewish nationalists, the prospect was tempting. Under the pressure of German racialism and with its assistance, the Zionist ideal might win that victory denied it in the humanitarian and democratic atmosphere of the Weimar Republic. If both the Zionists and the National Socialists regarded race and nationhood as universally valid criteria, some common ground must be discoverable between the two. As early as the 13th of June, 1933, the Jüdische Rundschau had come out into the open, quote, "Zionism recognizes the existence of a Jewish problem and desires a far-reaching and constructive solution. For this purpose, Zionism wishes to obtain the assistance of all peoples, whether pro- or anti-Jewish, because in its view, we are dealing here with a concrete rather than a sentimental problem and in the solution of which all peoples are interested." Next, Hoene goes on to describe an SS man named von Mildenstein's work in promoting this active cooperation between Zionist elements in Germany and the Third Reich. And apparently the efforts on the part of Mildenstein were quite successful, and there the official SS policy to the Jews changed from one of diehard and all-encompassing anti-Semitism to one of open sympathy for Zionist elements in Germany. Interestingly enough, the SS apparently even provided strong logistical support to training centers for Jewish youth to be sent to work in the kibbutzim in the Middle East, the collective agricultural developments in Palestine. This pattern of cooperation between the SS and German Zionists is basically presented here by Hoene as follows. Keep in mind now, von Mildenstein is the SS man in charge of Jewish affairs at this point in the development of the Third Reich. At this point, von Mildenstein stepped in. The task of the SD, by the way, the SD is the SS Intelligence Service, beginning again. The task of the SD, he argued, was to turn the German assimilated Jews back into conscious Jews, to promote dissimilation in order to awaken in the breasts of the largest possible number of Jews the urge to go to Palestine, the only country open at the time to large-scale Jewish immigration. Himmler seized on Mildenstein's plan and set him to work. Within the SD Hauptamt, Mildenstein set up a Jewish desk entitled 2112. A period of SS Jewish policy began in which, according to Hans Lahm, last name L-A-M-M, quote, the adoption or affectation of a pro-Zionist attitude was in order, unquote. This new SS policy made its first appearance in the columns of the Schwarze Corps. In place of the paper's anti-Jewish tirades, references began to appear to the sensible, totally unsentimental Jew of the Zionist movement. The paper forecast, quote, the time cannot be far distant when Palestine will again be able to accept its sons who have been lost to it for over 1,000 years. Our good wishes, together with our official goodwill, go with them. Although Jewish emigration to Palestine was officially the responsibility of the Gestapo and the Reich Ministry of the Interior, the SD now began to force the pace. Between 1933 and 1937, 24,000 Jews had left for Palestine. The SD now increased its pressure upon those still willing to emigrate. Von Mildenstein gave all possible support to the Zionist organization's retraining camps, where young Jews were trained for the farm work which they would have to do in Palestine's kibbutzim. He kept close watch on the work of the Zionists and maintained large-scale maps in his office showing the progress of Zionism among German Jewry. Well, the final element that I'd like to present to you basically concerns the close affiliation and, in fact, a working relationship that was established between the SS and specifically the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, and the Haganah, which was basically a Zionist defense organization which incorporated, among other things, a very effective and important worldwide Zionist espionage system, okay? Basically, it was sort of, among other things, the Zionist intelligence wing. And basically, a working relationship was established here between the SS and a Haganah man named Fivel Polkesh, last name P-O-L-K-E-S. And apparently Polkesh was able to make contact with several of the SS leaders in charge of Jewish matters, notably Adolf Eichmann, later executed for his part in exterminating European Jews. And basically Polkesh, Eichmann, and another SS man named Albert Hagen, at that point Eichmann's superior, were put in contact with Fivel Polkesh by a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. Now, Otto von Bolschwing is a fellow we're going to talk about at some length in the future on Hard Rain. Basically, he was also at one point Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the Jewish affairs for the SS, and von Bolschwing later went on to become head of Reinhard Gehlen's North American operation. You recall that Gehlen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front, who then jumped with his entire organization to the CIA and then in turn to NATO and finally to West Germany, where Gehlen's organization, the organization he founded, is the West German Intelligence Service to this day. Okay, and Otto von Bolschwing, the fellow who formed the contact between the Haganah and the SS, became head of Gehlen's entire North American operation. Okay. Beginning here with Hoene's account of the working relationship established between Fivel Polkesh, acting on behalf of the Haganah and the SS, Hoene writes as follows. Mere control of the Zionists in Germany, however, did not satisfy Hagen and Eichmann. If they were really to estimate the chances of formation of a Jewish state, they had to force their way into the nerve center of the Zionist movement itself. The opportunity to do so came via an old friend of von Mildenstein. This was Otto von Bolschwing, last name V-O-N-B-O-L-S-C-H-W-I-N-G-H, a party member, an SD informer, and an experienced salesman in the motor trade. Von Bolschwing was in contact with a group of Palestinian Germans who lined their pockets by certain extramural intelligence activities. Among them was Dr. Reichert, the German news agency's Jerusalem correspondent. Reichert, in turn, possessed contacts with one of the leaders of a secret Zionist organization, the Haganah, which, with the exception of the British Intelligence Service, fascinated the SD more than any other institution. Eichmann's comment on the Haganah in his 1936 brochure had been, quote, all parties and formations included in the Zionist World Organization are kept under observation by a central counter-espionage and supervisory office, which plays an extraordinarily important role in Jewish political life. This office is known as Haganah, translated self-defense. The Haganah was not only the Jewish settlers' military defense organization, but in addition, maintained a widespread espionage system. On the headquarters staff of this secret army, there was a chartered accountant named Pavel Polkesh, last name P-O-L-K-E-S, born in Poland on the 11th of September 1900, who drew considerable sums for Dr. Reichert for occasional scraps of information. Polkesh carried the rank of commander in the Haganah, and according to Hagen, was responsible for, quote, running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews. I'm going to repeat that last sentence. This fellow Polkesh, who worked with the SS, as we're going to see in a minute, quote, according to Albert Hagen, was responsible for running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews. Now, the next section of Hona's text here basically delineates the contact between Polkesh, Eichmann, and Hagen, and basically indicates that Polkesh not only was willing to work with the SD, with the SS Intelligence Service, but basically that he was acting here in his capacity as an official representative of the Haganah, that basically the policy he was putting into effect represented official Haganah policy. Hona writes as follows. Section 2.1.12 evinced interest in the Haganah commander, and in February 1937, Polkesh journeyed to Berlin. On the 26th of February, he and Eichmann met. On the first occasion, Eichmann entertained him at the Traba restaurant near the zoo. During the return match, Polkesh invited Eichmann to Palestine. Polkesh was, of course, no ordinary agent. His object, he explained to Eichmann, was to accelerate Jewish immigration into Palestine so that the Jews in their homeland might outnumber the Arabs. For this purpose, he was already working with the British and French secret services and was only too willing to cooperate with Hitler Germany. On the 17th of June, 1937, Eichmann's office noted, quote, he, Polkesh, was prepared, among other things, to give powerful support to German foreign policy interests in the Middle East, on condition that German currency regulations were relaxed for Jews emigrating to Palestine. Gradually, the SD realized that Polkesh had not made the journey to Berlin on his own initiative. He was patently representing the immigration policy of the Haganah. Eichmann minuted, quote, as a quid pro quo, the following assurances could be given to Polkesh. Pressure would be exerted upon the German Jewish settlers to place an obligation on all Jews emigrating from Germany to go to Palestine and not to any other country. Such a measure is completely in line with German interests, and preparatory steps have already been taken by the Gestapo. At 8:50 a.m. on the 26th of September, 1937, Eichmann and Hagen boarded a train and set off to crown these first cautious steps toward an SS-Haganah alliance. Okay, so the Zionist-fascist connection is not nearly as obscure as it might appear, and it, in fact, is quite well documented.
That from 1982 once again. I think that there is a strong analogy that can be made between the fascist Zionists, and in particular, the sort of common ground that the that elements of the Zionist movement found with the Nazis and the SS in what might be termed the pre-final solution to the Jewish problem. Basically, both the SS, which wanted a Judenrein or Jew-free Europe, and the Zionist movement, which wanted to maximize and accelerate Jewish emigration to Palestine, they found common ground, at least for a period of time, and formed a cooperative relationship. And note again that certain pragmatic aspects of fascist and Nazi policy were viewed as being similar enough to certain aspects of anti-colonial or, in this case, Zionist policy that to permit elements which one would not normally assume would collaborate with fascism and Nazism to do just exactly that. Jews, for example, would be about the very last people in the world one would think of as working with the SS, and yet, for the reasons just set forth, they were, for a period of time, able to form just such an alliance, and also bear in mind the alliance between the Beit Harim, the fascist Zionists, and Mussolini fascisti in Italy as well. I think there's a very strong analogy that can be made between the position of the fascist element in the Zionist movement and certain black nationalist movements and individual so-called black militants from Marcus Garvey, who we're going to talk about in a minute, all the way on up to Elijah Muhammad, right on up through Louis Farrakhan and Khalid Muhammad today. In the very same issue of the San Francisco Examiner that I was reading from earlier, namely Tuesday, March 1st of 1994, there's a story right under the story about the enthusiasm that certain black college students feel for Khalid Muhammad, Farrakhan, etc. This is a story by Charles Hutzler, H-U-T-Z-L-E-R, of the Associated Press. It's headlined, Nation of Islam Aid Tones Down His Latest Farrakhan-Style Talk. Subheaded, Muhammad tells students he doesn't advocate blacks hating whites. There was an interesting detail as we skip down into this story of Muhammad. It says, he had been invited to speak on the legacy of Marcus Garvey, an early black nationalist who founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association in the 1920s. Muhammad, who was the Nation of Islam's national spokesman until he was demoted after the November speech, is also a member of the Garvey-founded group. Now, Marcus Garvey, of course, was arguably the first pan-Africanist, and although his movement could certainly not be described as fascist, there is little common ground between, a little ideological common ground between the corporatist philosophy of Mussolini, the first fascist, set forth, by the way, in considerable detail in the miscellaneous archive show called Uncle Sammy Del Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. Yet, in terms of style and methodology, Marcus Garvey himself felt there to be an affinity between his movement and the fascist political movement of Benito Mussolini in Italy. More significantly than that, the perceived common goal of Marcus Garvey's organization and white supremacist organizations like the Ku Klux Klan of effecting a complete separation of the races actually led not only to a degree of political affinity between the Ku Klux Klan and Marcus Garvey's organization, but an actual alliance between a Ku Klux Klan functionary named E.S. Cox, C-O-X, and Marcus Garvey. Again, as strange bedfellows as the Ku Klux Klan and Marcus Garvey's organization would appear to be, in fact, because of their mutual emphasis on racial separation, just like the SS and the Zionists' mutual emphasis on ethnic separation, which led to their pattern of cooperation, that led to, as I say, a degree of affinity and even a minimal cooperative operation between Marcus Garvey's organization and the Ku Klux Klan. Beyond that, as I said, Garvey himself, and we're going to hear it in his own words, felt a degree of affinity between his organization and the fascists of Mussolini's Italy. We're turning again to the book that we were reading from earlier, Fascism Today, A World Survey, published in 1969 by Pantheon Books, a division of Random House, co-authored by Angelo Del Boca and Mario Giovanna. And by the way, we're going to be taking a look now at the historical evolution of the alliance between black nationalists or African nationalists in the United States and in the Americas and explicitly fascist elements, a pattern which I think is analogous to the alliance in many ways between the alliance, analogous in many ways to the alliance between the fascist Zionists and some of the fascist powers of Europe. In Fascism Today, the authors write as follows. As long ago as 1920, after proclaiming himself in New York as provisional president of Africa, the Jamaican Marcus Garvey tried to unite all Negroes under one flag and demanded, quote, not law but force, not justice but power, unquote. Countering white racialism with a rabid Negro racialism, Garvey founded a church of his own in which the angels were black and Satan was white. He suggested the creation of a black house in opposition to the White House and formed a paramilitary Universal African Legion, unquote, and even expressed his approval of the Ku Klux Klan, which he claimed was useful because it encouraged Negro nationalism. This last item again. And even expressed his approval of the Ku Klux Klan, which he claimed was useful because it encouraged Negro nationalism. Again, not a perfect analogy, but I think a valid and important analogy between the fascist Zionist alliance of the World War II period. And by the way, those fascist Zionists are the historical predecessors of elements like the Kahani forces today. Notes the alliance between the Ku Klux Klan, or the affinity between the Ku Klux Klan, as we shall see in a minute, even involving a degree of political alliance, and the Garvey organization. Political strange bedfellows, if ever there were. Continuing. Later, Garvey was frequently compared with Hitler on account of his torrent-like rhetoric and his ability to arouse the most primitive emotions of the masses. He himself frankly admitted that his doctrine was based on racial fascism. Quote, and this is Marcus Garvey being quoted directly here, "We were the first fascists. We had disciplined men, women, and children in training for the liberation of Africa. The black masses knew that in this extreme nationalism lay their only hope, and they readily supported it. Mussolini copied fascism from me, but the Negro reactionaries sabotaged it," unquote. Now, again, I want to repeat something I said earlier. I do not view Garvey's movement as a fascist movement. It certainly was far removed. Black nationalism or African nationalism is far removed ideologically from the corporatist philosophy that was the foundation of Mussolini's fascism and also Hitler's fascism. Yet at the same time, from an organizational and perhaps one could term a psychosocial standpoint, there certainly were elements of common ground between Garvey's organization and fascism. The creation of a militant, coordinated cadre, the potential advocacy of violence, and also, in this case, the emphasis on racial separation, which led to an alliance and affinity between the Ku Klux Klan and Garvey's organization, have led to the formation of this particular political alliance, and again, an alliance that could certainly be termed strange bedfellows if ever there were. Again, although not a fascist, certainly Garvey himself felt there to be a stylistic and methodological affinity with the forces of fascism, even claimed that Mussolini copied fascism from him, and note again his approval of the Ku Klux Klan for reasons stated there. Very similar, in my opinion, to the alliance between the fascist Zionists and the SS, as well as the forces of Mussolini as well. And again, the exploitation of anti-colonial sentiments as well as the mystification of ideological polarities is one of the things that has permitted fascism historically to utilize these seemingly disparate elements. Skipping ahead in history to the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, the predecessor to Louis Farrakhan and Khalid Muhammad. The authors write in Fascism Today, "To achieve these results, the messenger of Allah makes the black Muslim celebrate rites and swear oaths. He imposes an austere way of life, places them under the orders of captains, and to those whom he recruits from among the fruit of Islam, he entrusts the defense of the sect, its members, and their poverty. In 30 years, Muhammad has thus given his movement the structure of a secret military society." Skipping down. "In fact, even if we admit that its inspiration is dynamic and genuine, and that its protest is the silent protest of at least three-quarters of the American Negroes, the fact remains that its underlying ideology is grotesque and dangerous and contains much that is undoubtedly irrational." Again, I would note that it is the ideological mystification of fascism, permitting the tactical union of polar opposites, which permits the sort of political alliance that we're going to be looking at in just a minute. The irrational aspect of some of the political ideology, the political philosophy, and of the political relationships of the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad can be seen as follows. Again, returning to Fascism Today, "The black Muslims' latest paradoxical exploit was their pact with the neo-Nazis of the American Nazi Party, which reminds us of the close alliance 40 years ago between Marcus Garvey and E.S. Cox of the Ku Klux Klan. Lincoln Rockwell," that's George Lincoln Rockwell, the Fuhrer of the American Nazi Party, "Lincoln Rockwell was frequently a guest at meetings of Negro extremists, and he has said that he considers Elijah Muhammad to be, quote, one of the greatest men in the world," unquote. The black Muslims also expressed their approval of Verwoerd, that's Hendrik Verwoerd of South Africa, of course, a diehard advocate of apartheid. So here again, we're looking at some very, very strange bedfellows. The black Muslims allied with not only George Lincoln Rockwell, but expressing approval for Hendrik Verwoerd, the leader of South Africa, an ardent supporter of the apartheid system. Continuing, and bear in mind the connections between the Third Reich and the Bruderbund, the main Afrikaner nationalist organization. Continuing. "The black Muslims also expressed their approval of Verwoerd, V-E-R-W-O-E-R-D, who introduced apartheid in South Africa, and of Governor Wallace of Alabama for the support he gave to segregation. Conversely, the Texan oil magnates and the John Birch Society have never attempted to hide their sympathy for this Negro extremist movement. Malcolm X, who ranked immediately below Elijah Muhammad in the sect's hierarchy,
claimed that there was a, quote, perfect identity of views, unquote, between the black Muslims and the neo-Nazis because they were both fighting for a complete separation of the two races. That, again, is very reminiscent of the elements of the fascist Haganah Alliance, or the Nazi Haganah Alliance. Continuing. At the time of the Negro, quote, March on Washington, unquote, these two radical movements confirmed that they were allies by adopting the same hostile attitude to, quote, moderate, unquote, Negroes, and alleging that the march had been financed and organized by the federal government itself. They also agreed in expressing their satisfaction after the assassination of President Kennedy, though when Malcolm X was rash enough to say so at a meeting of 700 black Muslims, Elijah Muhammad announced that his chief lieutenant had been temporarily suspended. I would note that eventually Malcolm X broke with Elijah Muhammad and changed his views on a number of different subjects. And indeed, one of the things that was alarming to Malcolm X, and we've spoken about this in the past, and it can be documented in the book The Judas Factor by Carl Evans, was that one of the major financial supporters of the Nation of Islam was none other than Texas right-wing, ultra-right-wing oil billionaire H.L. Hunt, an individual whose political and financial empire had strong connections with residual Third Reich elements, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 37. By the way, I refer interested listeners to the book, the recent book, The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, to document some of the explicit fascist connections of the Hunt empire. So note again the similarity between the pattern of cooperation between the fascist Zionists and the fascist powers of Europe. Note the similarity in cooperation between Garvey and the Ku Klux Klan, the Garvey organ elements and the Ku Klux Klan. And note the similarity between that alliance and the working alliance between George Lincoln Rockwell and his American Nazi Party and the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad. Also, again, note the affinity of the Nation of Islam for such strange bedfellows as Hendrik Verwoerd, who introduced apartheid in South Africa, and Governor Wallace of Alabama. I shouldn't say who introduced, but who advocated apartheid and ardently supported apartheid in South Africa. And note to the support of the Nation of Islam for George Wallace. And again, the ideological mystification that fascism engages in as a matter of course, plus the common ground of racial and or religious separatism between seeming opposites, are two of the factors that have permitted political alliances of this type. We're next going to turn to a book from 1970, a very good book, unfortunately long out of print and not easy to get a hold of. This book is called Power on the Right. It's authored by former FBI agent turned investigative reporter and author William W. Turner, and published in hardcover by the Ramparts Press, copyright 1970 or 71? Anyway, I will tell you in just a second. Copyright 1971. There is some interesting discussion in here, not only of the American Nazi Party, but of the paramilitary right and of some of the elements that the Nation of Islam have found common ground with. I would note, by the way, before moving to this next segment, that as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 13, the Nation of Islam under Louis Farrakhan has also established political alliances with neo-fascists such as Tom Metzger and Michigan Ku Klux Klansman Robert Miles, both with strong connections to the Aryan Nation's neo-Nazi umbrella network. I would also note that the American Nazi Party and overlapping elements such as the National States Rights Party, the Ku Klux Klan, the Minutemen paramilitary organization, these are institutions which, in turn, have political alliances to some extremely wealthy and powerful individuals. There are also elements of overlap between the paramilitary right and the racist right, so-called operational-level Nazis, and elements of our national security establishment. Also, I think there is a very strong, I think one could make a very good comparison between the way that Jews were used by the Nazis in the Third Reich and the way people of color, Afro-Americans in particular, are used in contemporary America. Many of the Nazi leaders were quite forthcoming in their private writings that it was not actually the Jews who were responsible for Germany's economic problems as they espoused in their political writings, but rather it was deemed necessary to unite the German people against a perceived common internal enemy, and it was important to be able to blame Germany's economic problems on that enemy. For that reason, the Jews were scapegoated for Germany's problems. I maintain that there is a similar process of scapegoating that is at work in this country and has been for many, many years. when Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and others talk about the need to hold down government spending, despite the fact that they have done a very poor job. Ronald Reagan and George Bush in particular had the highest budget deficits in history. Reagan tripled the national debt because of those budgets in 8 years. And George Bush added a nice little lump sum on top of that. Despite the fact that those individuals were the greatest government spenders of all time, they continued to get away with their political battle cry of the need to hold down government spending. That, basically, is because the cry or the perceived, the political rhetoric about holding down government spending was well recognized by their political constituencies to be, in effect, a racist code word. And listeners will forgive my use of strong language. Basically, what that meant is, let's get those niggers and spicks off of welfare. It didn't mean, let's hold down government spending on multi-billion-dollar defense projects, which may or may not be needed or useful or even operational from a functional standpoint. It meant, basically, let's stop spending our hard-earned tax dollars on welfare for all those niggers and Mexicans and so forth. Of course, our hard-earned tax dollars, quote-unquote, do not go, for the most part, to support people on welfare. But the perception, the political perception, that much of our economic distress in recent decades has been because of the welfare state, because people of color are being lazy in collecting welfare that in turn is derived from the tax dollars of hard, honest working people, that perception is essentially the perception which underlies much of the political philosophy and much of the political success of Ronald Reagan and George Bush and similar elements. One of my fears is that if the United States should experience a serious economic crisis in the future, the short-term economic news would appear to be good, and I hope that's right. Certainly the projections are optimistic at this stage of the game. But at some point in the future, if the United States finds itself in an economic crisis, I think that the process of scapegoating people of color, black Americans in particular, for America's economic problems is likely to grow more severe. And I think the possibility of a final solution to the black problem or Negro problem or whatever is not a possibility that should be dismissed by the would-be critic. We're going to turn now to Power on the Right by William W. Turner, and we're going to take a look at the perceptions of a Ku Klux Klan leader named Roy Frankhauser. Frankhauser himself, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 13, has himself worked as a contract agent for the Central Intelligence Agency. Turner writes of Frankhauser, by the way, Frankhauser is F-R-A-N-K-H-O-U-S-E-R, short and wiry with a bristly mustache, Frankhauser has been a staunch Depew loyalist. By the way, Depew, capital D-E, capital P-U-G-H, is the head of and the founder of the Minutemen, a paramilitary right-wing group about which we're going to have more to say in a minute. Continuing, or resuming where we left off, short and wiry with a bristly mustache, Frankhauser has been a staunch Depew loyalist. Quote, Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, unquote. He was quoted in the June 1969 Playboy piece. This last sentence again, because I think in many ways it is critical to an understanding of the theme of the second part of tonight's program. Hitler had, quote, Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, unquote. He was quoted in the June 1969 Playboy piece. Quote, we have to put our main stress on the nigger question, of course, because that's what preoccupies the masses. But we're not forgetting the Jew, unquote. Despite his firebrand language, Frankhauser is nobody's fool. Quote, for the first time since Huey Long, he analyzed, the stage is set for the rise of an American brand of fascism. Not that right-wingers can take any credit for it. The race riots have done our work for us. The black nationalists are our biggest recruiting agents. I wish there were 100 Stokely Carmichaels and Rap Browns. After each Watts, each Detroit, we get thousands of new backlash members, and best of all, a big slice of them are disgruntled cops and National Guardsmen, unquote. Note that Stokely Carmichael and H. Rap Brown were black nationalist leaders of the 1960s and early 70s, and also known for their fiery rhetoric. And note that Roy Frankhauser is viewing individuals of that type as valuable recruiting tools for recruiting not only people, but especially disgruntled cops and National Guardsmen into the ranks of organizations like the Minutemen, Ku Klux Klan, American Nazi Party, etc. An historical note about Frankhauser, and this is also covered in Radio Free America 13, skipping down to a footnote on that page. Frankhauser was in the news when, on October 31st, 1965, one Daniel Burros, B-U-R-R-O-S, committed suicide in Frankhauser's Reading home. Brilliant and psychotic, Burros had alternately belonged to the American Nazi Party the National Renaissance Party, the American Racial Fascist Party, and the KKK. He was on the staff of George Lincoln Rockwell's magazine, The Stormtrooper, resigning in 1962 to edit Kill, which was, quote, dedicated to the annihilation of the enemies of the white people, unquote. Interestingly, too, his name and address, as well as Rockwell's, were in the notebook of accused assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. Burroughs shot himself when the New York Times printed evidence that he was part Jewish. I would note that although it's not mentioned here in the book The Klan by Patsy Sims, Roy Frankhauser himself notes the curious circumstances surrounding Daniel Burroughs' suicide, a three-bullet suicide. As Frankhauser notes, bad case of suicide. Yep, very bad case indeed. More about this paramilitary milieu that we're looking at and that is exemplified by the likes of Daniel Burroughs and Roy Frankhauser and George Lincoln Rockwell, again, who's the latter two being individuals whose names, addresses, etc. were in Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest, Oswald the supposed Marxist. Talking about an attempted flight from prison, a prison escape that Robert Depew engaged in, and Robert Depew, again, the founder and leader of the Minutemen paramilitary right-wing group, Depew maintained that he had been marked for death by an extremist element of the radical paramilitary right, and that this particular element enjoyed the sympathies of the FBI, so there was no need in going to them. By the way, we should note that even though there are alliances between many of these domestic fascist groups, there are also sharp divisions as well. Continuing with Power on the Right by William Turner. Of Robert Depew, Turner writes, there were indications, he explained, that an opposing element of the radical right had marked him for death, and there had been no point in seeking protection from the FBI because this very element cooperated closely with the Bureau. Although Depew tends to be cryptic, at least with outsiders, I presume that he was alluding to a Minuteman splinter group that he has described as a, quote, Nazi clique, unquote, in a telephone conversation in October of 1967. There is no mistaking Depew's antipathy toward the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, and I suspect that his remark about fascism coming to the United States in the guise of anti-communism was aimed in Rockwell's direction. Depew seemed to delight in the fact that Rockwell's assassin was a double agent, his, but he didn't downgrade the Nazi commander's organizational prowess. Quote, when I proposed that the ANP might have been a gross burlesque given the swaggering and posturing of its central characters, he replied, quote, not at all. It had the best underground in the right wing, unquote. But that takes money, I persisted. Rockwell had it, he retorted. One of his principal sources was Clint Murchison, unquote. And in a footnote to that passage, we find, Depew clarified that he was referring to the late Clint Murchison Sr., the Dallas Oil multimillionaire. Murchison, incidentally, was especially close to J. Edgar Hoover, hosting him each August at his Del Charro Motel in La Jolla, California. Rockwell was not exactly hostile to the FBI. In explaining to reporter George Thayer why he would have the FBI round up all the Jews, he said, quote, Hoover is our kind of people. He talks like a pink, but when he acts like a white man, unquote. And I would note that the Murchison family figures prominently in the background of the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. The Great Southwest Corporation, a joint of Murchison Rockefeller Capital Venture, one of the elements that figures very prominently in Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. People from that organization deeply involved in the handling of Marina Oswald and the cover story in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We've also looked at connecting links between residual Third Reich elements and the Hunt Financial Empire and the ICCC, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, in the aforementioned Radio Free America 37. And indeed, it should not come as a surprise to find alliances between the likes of George Lincoln Rockwell and some of the other members of this paramilitary milieu and extremely wealthy and influential people like the Murchisons and the Hunts, because indeed many of our most powerful industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist and pro-Nazi prior to and during and after World War II. And note, especially here, that the same elements that are talking so threateningly and are viewing the black community as basically Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, these same elements are also extremely anti-Semitic. And again, the theme of this part of the program is strange bedfellows. And note that elements that are threatened by the forces of fascism, such as blacks and Jews, yet at the same time have found in the past, historically, because of the ideological mystification that fascism has engaged in, as well as certain practical elements of common ground, such as racial and or religious separatism, they have actually been able to work with the very fascist elements which would appear to be their ideological opposites and which are certainly their racial enemies. And note again that elements that are bitterly opposed to each other historically, such as the Grand Mufti, the forces grouped around him and its successors in succeeding decades, and the fascist Zionists, the Beit Harim, the Stern Gang, the elements grouped around the Haganah and Five-O Polkish in the pre-World War II period, they have found common ground with the very Nazis that were supporting their bitter enemies, elements like the Grand Mufti. Note that ultimately the ideological mystification notwithstanding and the temporary alliances formed by these seemingly strange bedfellows notwithstanding, ultimately the forces of fascism have the same basic fate in mind for blacks as for Jews, and that, folks, is a trip to the gas chamber and liquidation. Ultimately, the blacks and Jews, for all of the enmity that appears to be precipitated between them under the circumstances, if the fascists get their way, they will be separate but equal. That wraps things up for us for this evening.
Now, all of our archive broadcast shows are on permanent file with the Tape Duplication Company. The name of that company is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They're located at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. I should also mention that neither myself nor the station makes any money off of this announcement. This is FYI. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.